everybody. Welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Brawley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of Adventureland by my favorite carnival worker, Alex Lawson.
Guys, I don't know if you know this, Patrick used to podcast with Lou Reed.
As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Like us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdict.com and click on the movie podcast tab. Thank you to Michael Staley and everybody at DVD Verdict for hosting our show. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Did I get everything?
I think you said like us on Twitter.
It's possible that I said like us on Twitter. Yeah, it's all a blur. I mean, you can Twitter, stumble upon us at Twitter and foursquare us at MySpace. Also, you can find us in the iTunes store, but only our 99 most recent shows. You have to go to fthismovie.net to find all of our old shows. I have no idea why it's 99 and not 100, but...
Well, don't make it sound like it's such a chore either. I mean, the people should go to the website and poke around.
There are
there are some good shows in the classics.
There's Avatar. Cuts. That's our first show.
The deep cuts, I call them.
Yeah, nice.
The deep cuts.
So if you go on iTunes, it's like, I got 99 shows, but Avatar ain't
Avatar
one.
Avatar ain't one. No, it's not.
Alex, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Have you seen anything good lately?
I've seen some interesting stuff.
All right.
I haven't really seen too many good things. I recently saw Moonrise Kingdom again.
Okay.
With my girlfriend who hadn't seen it. We don't have to really rehash it. I think I even talked about it on here and it's been talked about a lot, but, it held up on a second viewing. I'll say I liked it just as much, if not a little bit more. But as far as new stuff, I saw a movie called, Compliance.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even have the courtesy to like have my iPhone open to look at what the name of the director is. I don't even know what his name is. I'll look it up while we're doing this. But anyway, I saw Compliance.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I have not. I know it was kind of a rage at some of the festivals. And when I read the plot synopsis, it sounded very familiar. And that's because my wife, Erica, loves watching like Dateline and 2020 Friday night.
Yeah,
and I happened to be in the room one night when they did this story, this crazy story that eventually was turned into the movie Compliance. So go ahead.
Right, right, right. By the way, Craig Zobel is the
name
of the writer.
Oh, sure. Craig E. Z? You forgot Craig E. Z?
Well, see, this is why I wanted to say his name.
My man Zobel. Yeah.
The Zobes.
The Zoban?
You don't mess with the Zobel. I went and saw Compliance, and I knew nothing about Compliance. All I knew is that there was a movie called Compliance that was getting really good reviews. out of a lot of the festivals, the local Landmark Theater, East Street Cinema in downtown Washington that I go to for like small and foreign films, said we've got Compliance. Everybody loves it. We've only got it for a limited run. It was only going to be there till like Thursday, and I think I saw it two Sundays ago. And I knew nothing about it, and I won't really spoil it here.
Can you give just a little idea of what the movie's about for people who have never heard of it, like yourself, prior to seeing it?
Well, see, here's the thing, is that I think it's best knowing zero, but that doesn't mean I don't have something interesting to say about it, because form an opinion.
Yes.
I will just say that it is about something really, really terrible that really happened a while ago.
Yes.
In Kentucky, I think?
Yes.
In the mid-2000s.
Sure. I said yes, but I have no idea.
I think it is, because after I saw it, I then went and binged on, like, all the articles. I think it took place in Kentucky. But it's about something terrible that happened at a fast food restaurant in Kentucky. That's all I'll really say. But I'll spoil it.
It's the invention of the Double Down sandwich, everyone. It's about the creation of the KFC Double Down.
It's a prolonged examination of our national nightmare of the Double Down sandwich. It's about something really terrible. And after it was over, I mean, it's a really interesting movie. It's very competently directed and written and acted, all that stuff. But whenever I was struggling with just this one conceit, and that is like when you make a movie about something terrible that really happened, I feel like you need to have something to say about the event in a way that puts it in some sort of either context or gives you some sort of perspective. I don't think it really is necessary to just literally replay and sort of fictionalize something awful that happened that nobody would ever really want to relive.
Right.
And as good as the movie is, and it's a very sort of interesting thriller, I was left feeling really, like, dirty. I don't know if I'm getting, like, really, I don't know.
My understanding is that that's a common response to the movie, that some people, I think, walked out, including critics, because they didn't like, you know, the way the movie made them feel. But what it sounds like to me is, would the movie have been better served or even different had it just been a documentary about the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's it. And I don't know why that is better to me, other than you're, like, going to the real people to tell their story.
Well, because once you sort of, you know, quote-unquote fictionalize it,
yeah,
you've removed it one step by turning it into this narrative. And then, like you said, you want to understand why that's a better approach.
Yeah, yeah. And I read those stories, too, about, like, people really, like, grossed out and, like, people walked out. I never considered walking out.
Right.
Like, you have to be some kind of real pretentious douchebag to do that. But, like,
because the movie isn't sensationalizing anything. It's just presenting things.
No, not at all.
They're objecting to what happened, not the treatment of what happened. And that's like a child. I mean.
Yeah, it's just really rough. Because then I looked back and I'm like, well, what did I really learn or take away from this tale unfolding before me? And I don't. Basically, what I'm saying is that even though it's very good and it has, you know, it has, you know, it's not like some poorly made, like, B-movie schlock about, like, you know, it could easily, in the hands of a really bad director, it could play, like, some terrible Lifetime movie, and it wasn't really like that.
Yeah.
But I don't ever think, I have no compulsion to ever watch Compliance again.
Now, you immediately went out and applied to be a night manager at Burger King, so I feel like you learned all the wrong lessons, no?
It casts a spell, you know? I mean, you don't want to like it, but there's something that compels you. And I quickly knew that was a bad decision, and I've since, you know, backed off it. But
it's so rare to see a sort of a narrative treatment of a movie. I don't know, in recent years, I've seen this happen a couple times where, like, I'll see one of these stupid 2020 things.
Yeah.
Or I'll see a documentary, and then someone will make the narrative version of that, and it's very rare that the narrative version is any better. There's a story going around called Tall Hot Blonde, and it's been told in every venue, and it's a fascinating story. So they've done it a bunch of times on these news magazine shows. There's a documentary made called Tall Hot Blonde that used to be on Netflix. Check it out. Tall only has one L, and it's all one word.
Okay.
But then a couple months ago, I think Courtney Cox, like, directed a Lifetime movie about it, and what's his name was the lead. Garrett Dillahunt is his name.
Oh, of course.
And he's one of these guys that you recognize because he's in everything. And he's a really good actor. And
he is.
It was so lame, and I just had to wonder, why is this treatment better than sort of a documentary treatment? And is it just?
Yeah.
Is it just a way of creating an inroad for somebody who would never watch a documentary?
That really might be it. And the thing, this Compliance isn't really, like, schlocky or poorly made.
I don't mean to compare it to this Lifetime movie, but
it's a little bit of a different thing. but the central sort of question you ask yourself is still the same. Like, it's just sort of why did I sit through that?
Yeah.
But everyone should say I think it's gone from most places now, but if you can seek it out, I mean, I'm sure it seems like one of those movies that's bound for a Netflix instant release at some point. So I'm sure it'll, make the rounds, and you should definitely check it out. I'm not saying don't see it, but especially, I'd like to hear what you think. So check out Compliance if you can, have a bath drawn for yourself at the ready. What else? Sorry, yeah, we can move on. I saw Celeste and Jesse Forever.
Another movie that I've been wanting to check out and have not.
That was an interesting movie. A couple of things. It appears to me like when I saw Celeste and Jesse Forever, I didn't really know that much about it. I just knew it was sort of one of these, like, here's a romantic comedy if you're sick of, like, really poorly made sort of assembly line types of romantic comedies that don't really give you credit for thinking and make, you know, movies that are about caricatures of people and stuff. But I will say that even though It stars Rashida Jones and Andy Samberg. They are married but separated, but still have this friendship. They're still friends, and then their lives start to go in different directions, and lessons are learned, skins are thickened, and all that. It's one of the best performances Rashida Jones has ever given in anything, including her first season of The Office, where I thought she just did great work. She's really good. I will say that the first thought when I was done watching Celeste and Jesse Forever is I don't know what we make of Andy Samberg movie star. I really don't. Yeah. I like quickly looked up his IMDb stuff and like I know he was in the terrible Adam Sandler movie.
Yes.
But then like he has not been the male lead of a movie since like he did Hot Rod and that movie came out 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's sort of an underrated comedy, I think.
Definitely. Definitely.
But this is a movie where this is not like that at all. He has a couple of moments that you consider to be like broad comedy moments in the movie. And other than that, he's like just playing like an adult. He's sort of an endearing slacker type. This movie is like a more mature meditation on the trope of like slacker guy can't get his act together. His uptight girlfriend deals with that.
Let me guess. He gets it together when it's too late. Oh,
yeah. It's a whole thing. It's interesting in that, you know, she gives, like I said, she gives a great performance.
She wrote it as well, right?
I did not know that.
Yeah. Her and she had a writing partner, man, and I don't remember his name. But they wrote it, so it kind of makes sense that she has this great part to play because she basically wrote it for herself.
She has a lot more to do than he does.
Yeah.
He is a vessel for a lot of action that you know gets played out. But it's interesting. It has a sort of like forehead slapping message tacked on to the last 5 minutes that really hurts it. There's a really brave spot they could have ended the movie. If you see it, you'll know what I'm talking about. And they don't. They go for a couple other minutes. It sort of left me with a bad taste in my mouth, so much so that when a person asked me the next day after I told them I saw Celeste and Jesse Forever, it was almost like I had that in my mind, the sort of bad ending, and I couldn't even really remember much else other than I liked Rashida Jones. So, you should definitely check it out if you can. This is another one that's hard to find. Damn it.
Yeah.
You know, it's good. The performances are good. It gives you a little bit of credit. Like I said, it attempts to be a sort of a more mature romantic comedy, but it has these weird moments of still attempting broad comedy, that look like they're from a different movie, which is always very distracting, kind of takes you out of it, but, it's pretty good. Like I said, it's worth it for Rashida Jones' performance. If I can give you a one liner on it, she is that good. Like she's
the reason that I want to see it at all. Yeah. I mean, I tend to like that kind of movie anyway, even when it's not good, and it so rarely is actually good.
Yeah.
But like a couple months ago, I went to see Your Sister's Sister, and really was excited because I like all the cast, and it's that same kind of just.
Yeah,
it's a certain age group talking about relationships, and it's sort of a comedy, but it's sort of dramatic, and it's like, hey, great, and that movie wasn't very good, and I've kind of gotten the vibe that Celeste and Jesse is going to be along those same lines, but I've not yet had a chance to see it.
I haven't seen My Sister's Sister either, but from just your
blow-by-blow
of it, it sounds like they might be pretty similar.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you see, let me ask you this, I know JB talked about it once on the show, did you ever see that movie, did you ever end up seeing that movie Take This Waltz?
No, not yet, and I was Erica and I were just talking about it, because I believe it's still available on demand, and I really want to see it, and,
I saw that movie a while ago, it's not like Celeste and Jesse Forever, there are no, like, that's a very different movie, it's not really, I mean, there are moments of comedy, but it does not aim to be funny, really, almost at all. I saw that movie like 6 weeks ago and we've rescheduled this show a couple of times and I meant to talk about it. I saw it a while ago and maybe I need to see it again, but I really like it. I can't, it's just one of those movies that I know it's got problems, but I can't, it has a very sort of compelling way of like, this sounds, oh God, I sound like Gene Shalit or something. It's like it really does, like, only because I can't think of any other words to say, it really does, like, cast a spell over you.
Yeah.
Like I really can't stop thinking about, like, the color palette that they use is very interesting. Michelle Williams is always great, even though she kind of is always in need of a hug. never more so.
Or in, like, later. A giant sweater and maybe soup.
It's some great work from Seth Rogen, too.
He's kind of the reason that I want to see that. I mean, Michelle Williams is always good, but I will never see a movie because Michelle Williams is in it.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, she's, every time I see her in something, I'm like, wow, she's really good, but she's never enough to make me say, like, ooh, I got to see the new Michelle Williams.
She's not a draw for you.
Not for me, but she is for a lot of people. But Seth Rogen, honestly, is the reason that I want to see that movie, because I know he gives more of a dramatic performance. And
It's good. So I saw those three things, and those are three things that people should see. I really, really like Take This Waltz. Those other two I could maybe give or take, but all should be sought out and pursued.
I feel terrible because it really seems like I don't see movies anymore, and I am on this movie podcast, and you just named three movies, and I'm like, oh, I want to see that, but I haven't. But I just rewatched Haywire because that showed up on Netflix Instant. And I was more than a little excited to see that movie. I believe Doug and I were declaring this the year of Haywire, and that it was going to be better than any movie ever made. And obviously the movie came out, and it was not better than any movie ever made. I liked it, but, you know, unfortunately it was competing with the movie that I maybe thought it was going to be. And so I watched it again, and I liked it better. I mean, I'm still not going to argue that it's a great movie, because I think it's still a very sort of slight movie, almost by design. But I think people were a little hard on it when it came out, maybe because they were expecting this nonstop sort of wall-to-wall action movie, maybe because they were expecting something different from Steven Soderbergh, or they didn't like Gina Carano as an actress. I don't know. People were weirdly harsh on Haywire, and I think it deserves a second look. I think it's good.
I still haven't seen Haywire. Didn't get around to it. Now that it's on Netflix, that'll be a lot.
You should watch it tonight because it's it's very, again, you have to sort of adjust your expectations, which shouldn't be
you
hard.
You and Doug had, like, much higher expectations than, I mean, I listened to a couple of those initial shows. And I was like, yeah, it looks pretty cool. I don't think that I don't think that will play into it. I'm just excited to see the movie.
You've gotten certainly more distance, and you've got a bunch of people saying, like, it's not that great. So you're not going into it. Like, I don't know what it was. I just thought the trailers were great. I had this sort of mad crush on Gina Carano, and I was so sure that it was going to be so awesome. And it's good. I think Steven Soderbergh's other movie this year, Magic Mike, is a better movie, but I think Haywire is underrated. The other movie I saw, well, I was not seeing good movies like Celeste and Jesse Forever. Well, not, I should say Take This Waltz. I instead, on Netflix Instant, while maybe pulling up Haywire, it was like other movies that you might watch.
Oh, sure.
Vertical Limit?
Oh, man. This is so crazy. I was just thinking about this the other day. I can't believe it.
Have you seen Vertical Limit?
I saw Vertical Limit in a movie theater.
Jesus fucking Christ. Okay, so Vertical Limit came out in like 2000, and I avoided it because I have some amount of intelligence. But I really thought at the time, like, it just looked so much like a Mountain Dew commercial, or like a cell phone was going to ring. It just seemed like a thing that tells you to turn your cell phone off, you know, like a joke movie. So I avoided it for years, and then it showed up on Netflix, and I was like, well, shit, I've never seen Vertical Limit. I'll check it out. And holy cow, it is, I won't say it's worse than I expected it to be, but it's at least as bad as I expected it to be. I didn't realize it was directed by Martin Campbell.
Yeah.
Until the end title came up. Like, I mean, that guy gets a ton of credit for making Casino Royale, which is a really good Bond movie and sort of reinvigorated the franchise. Sure. And I liked his first Zorro movie, which was The Mask of Zorro. I can't remember which one came first.
It's,
I think,
The Mask of Zorro.
Legend of Zorro is the one where, like, the kid shows up, and I never saw it.
Yeah, no. It's not that.
Kids ruin everything. So I never saw the sequel. But, you know, people forget that Martin Campbell also made Green Lantern, which is garbage, and he made Beyond Borders, which is absolute garbage, and he made Vertical Limit, which is so bad And a couple months ago, I had to watch for a review at DVD Verdict. I watched the movie Sanctum. Do you remember this movie at all? It's like the underwater cave diving movie that came out right on that. Yeah. James Cameron produced it. And it came out sort of on the heels of Avatar, and it was like...
Oh, yes, I remember this, because it was all like James Cameron presents Sanctum. Yeah, they did that trick, yeah.
It was 3D, and it sort of had his stamp of approval. And that was, honestly, I didn't put this together. That was another one when I would see the preview. I was positive a cell phone was going to ring, and it was just this fake movie. I really was. And that movie is terrible, and watching Vertical Limit, I was like, wow, this is Sanctum, only on a mountain.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. I honestly don't encourage people to watch things ironically ever. But if you have Netflix Instant, I say watch the first 10 minutes of Vertical Limit. You'll know exactly the point at which you should turn it off. There's a very clear stopping point. I mean, it is so hilariously bad. It's a sequence with Chris O'Donnell and Robin Tunney and... Stuart, I don't remember his name. I want to say he played like the bad guy in Ghostbusters 2 or Lethal Weapon 3. Those might not be the same guy. The point is this. They're climbing a mountain. It is so bad.
I could listen to your brain droppings on this
for
another hour.
Oh my God,
the
whole
movie
is so bad. And the whole time I'm just thinking about so much of it doesn't seem like it was actually shot on a mountain in the snow or outdoors. Like, it feels very fake, like they're on a soundstage. But then other sequences, they're clearly outside, and I just was like, boy, this had to be so miserable. If you're Chris O'Donnell, and you're shooting Vertical Limit, and you're just freezing for 2 months, and you're out in the snow every day, and why are you doing it? To be in Vertical Limit? Is it worth it, Chris O'Donnell? Is it worth it?
Man, okay, well, there's very little I can add to that. As I said, I saw Vertical Limit one time.
In a theater!
In a movie theater. I was, like, 15, you know, whatever. gosh, and it's really funny that you should mention this, because I actually, like, looked up Vertical Limit on Wikipedia the other day, because I couldn't remember, for whatever reason, I was thinking about it, and I couldn't remember if it took place on Mount Everest or K2. It takes place on K2. Not that that matters at all, because as you said, you can't really discern, like... you know, whatever the hell's happening. I think it's funny, though, that you say, and again, I have not seen it since I was 15 years old. I think it's funny that you say you should watch the first 10 minutes and you'll know when to turn it off. I don't recall enough detail of like how, you know, of like how the plot, like whatever, like how it all unfolds. But I do remember being, at least as a kid, really taken with that first scene. No. Am I wrong?
Like, I mean, I promise you are wrong.
I remember being, I just remember being really, I mean, I don't know. I don't even, like I said, I mean, I don't even know if I was like having a discerning eye, probably not.
You could not have been. Yeah. Without spoiling anything, if you listeners have seen Cliffhanger, Vertical Limit opens the same way as Cliffhanger, basically. Yeah. It has to set up a rift between a brother and a sister and create this psychology in the characters. And Cliffhanger does it so much better. I remember seeing Cliffhanger and having the reaction that you're talking about for Vertical Limit that I thought it was genuinely suspenseful. And oh my gosh, what are they going to do? Vertical Limit manufactures that suspense through the use of like very fast zooms and all of the characters shouting at one another, and they try and cut it faster and faster to sort of ratchet up the tension. I swear to God, watch just those 10 minutes again and you will be laughing at the fact that it ever worked on you. I promise you will pick up on all the terrible tricks. And,
I can't wait.
Oh, the movie is so bad. And the problem is that beyond those 10 minutes, if the whole movie had been able to sustain the insanity of those first 10 minutes, I would tell everyone to watch Vertical Limit.
Because it would be like crazy and interesting.
Yeah, but it mostly gets boring.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, it gets incredibly stupid.
Yeah.
And those parts are amusing. And there are six different kinds of terrible performances in the movie. Bill Paxton as like the evil guy who's trapped, and Scott Glenn as this long-haired... Oh my gosh. Scott Glenn is like the long-haired guide slash Sherpa I want to spoil something in the movie so badly. His wife has been missing for years.
Oh, yeah.
And at one point, I'm not going to spoil Vertical Limit, everyone.
Go for it.
He comes across her body, like there's this little avalanche, and where he happens to be standing... her body is revealed, like the snow falls away, and it's like, holy shit, there's my wife. I just happen to be in the right spot. And she's frozen solid, and there's no, like, skin damage. I'm like, when you died, you froze to death. You died of exposure. She has no frostbite. She has no visible. She just is a little bit blue and, like, frozen, like she's in a cartoon. And his first thought is to kiss her, which, fine, that's great. And I, listen, if I found Erica frozen after 2 years, I'd probably kiss her, too. But my first thought was, like, aren't your lips going to get stuck to her? And would that have been an interesting development?
You wouldn't kiss her because she wouldn't have a face.
Well, right.
Right.
I was thinking about, like, putting your tongue against a telephone pole. Like, wouldn't your lips automatically freeze to this button? No, apparently not. So, that was my favorite moment in the movie, and I was denied the sight of Scott Glenn's lips getting stuck to his dead ex-wife. Not ex-wife, his dead wife.
His dead, please.
She's ex because she's dead, but they're still married in his heart.
Some respect for that.
Anyway, it's an insanely bad movie. Let's talk about Adventureland, because we've talked about a lot of other stuff.
Yes, we have.
Adventureland came out in 2009, directed by Greg Mottola, who made Superbad and The Day Trippers and Paul, of which I was not a huge fan.
I didn't see Paul.
It's not very good.
I like those other movies, though.
Yeah, I'm a big Superbad fan. And, and he just directed the season finale of The Newsroom.
He directed a couple episodes of The Newsroom. He's like an exec producer. He's in the room. Like, he is in the think tank of The Newsroom.
Did you watch The Newsroom?
I've watched every episode of The Newsroom, actually.
Did you like The Newsroom?
You know, I sort of, like, embrace, like, the audacity of The Newsroom. I really do. Like,
What is the audacity? We can't talk about The Newsroom, but you're an Aaron Sorkin fan. B, you have worked in the newsrooms. So I was curious to get your opinion, but maybe we should talk about this off mic.
I was
shocked at how much I disliked The Newsroom, and I watched every episode. Okay, so Greg Mottola made Adventureland, a sort of coming-of-age movie set in 1987 based on his own experiences working at this theme park called Adventureland. It stars Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart and Ryan Reynolds. And when the movie came out, I remember it being advertised, and because it's Miramax, this happens all the time, as the wacky comedy starring Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. And they're this hilarious couple that runs an amusement park. And I think, you know,
From the director of Superbad.
Yeah, right, Letters, right. Yeah. I mean, and it casts Jesse Eisenberg, who lots of people consider sort of the Michael Cera doppelganger, so they're going in expecting basically the guy from Superbad and these people from Saturday Night Live. I don't think the movie was ever going to make a ton of money, no matter what. Yeah. Like, this isn't that kind of breakout success, but I do think they definitely shot themselves in the foot, because the people that they did get to come out to the theater, who they basically tricked into seeing Adventureland, came out of it saying, like, I didn't like that. It wasn't funny.
Yeah.
And the problem is, you know, the movie isn't really a comedy. Like,
not really. Yeah.
It has funny stuff in it, but it's not trying to be funny. And by tricking people into seeing something that it isn't, you destroy any chance the movie has at word of mouth, which is the only thing that's going to get people to see Adventureland.
A movie like that, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a classic misdirection case. And I'll even go so far as to say that, like, it's funny that they built it around, you know, especially with respect to Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig, you know, it's funny that they would sort of center the ad campaign or whatever around them, because they are funny performers. But, like, if anything, and this is a movie that I like a lot. I watched it for the first time for the purposes of this podcast. I'd never seen it before. I like the movie a lot. And if anything, like, they are part of what, in my opinion, doesn't always work. Like, and not because they're, like, bad and because they're not funny. They're very funny, but they almost, they quite literally feel like they're in a different movie, which is what the whole point of the marketing campaign was. And furthermore, I almost feel like it was reverse engineered, because their performances are so specifically odd with the tone of the rest of the movie that it almost feels like they had, like, I'm sure, like, they just had long takes of them doing funny stuff, and then maybe, I don't know, in the process of cutting the movie, they thought, well, you know, it's not funny enough, it's not really, like, playing how we maybe wanted, we have to sort of get some more laughs in there, I guess. I mean, I don't know who's in the room when this stuff happens, but, like, it feels very shoehorned.
Yeah.
I was
going to basically say all that same stuff, that it does feel like you could take their scenes out of the movie and the movie would not be any worse off for it, possibly even better. And that, yeah, that they sat down, because their scenes do feel separate from the rest of the action. Every once in a while they'll interact with, like, Jesse Eisenberg, but their scenes are sort of self-contained. And so it's like somebody sat down and said, oh, this movie's not funny enough, and went back and, like, shot scenes of them. And I don't think that's what happened. I think it's probably closer to what you described, but it does feel like every once in a while the movie stops for the Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig show, and then it goes back to being this coming-of-age story set in 1987. But we're getting very specific very early on, and let's give maybe a bigger overview of the movie. I like Adventureland a lot. I think it's a good movie, and I think there's a good chance that a lot of people won't tune into this podcast because they've never seen it, or if you've tuned in and you've never seen it, we'll probably be spoiling things later on, but you should check it out. The movie's available on Netflix Instant. It's a movie that really kind of slipped through the cracks. And so it's kind of a weird movie for us to be doing for a podcast, because we tend to try and do movies that maybe more people have seen. But every once in a while, it's nice to bring attention to a smaller movie that deserves it. I like the movie a lot. I will say, I think I liked it a little bit better in 2009 when I saw it, because watching it this time, for the podcast, certain things were sticking out at me. And again, I wonder if it's like we were talking about earlier, if it's just a function of expectations, where I went in, you know, expecting what had been advertised, which was this wacky comedy. And when it, but knowing Greg Mottola, I mean, I also had a good indication that, like, that's probably not what it is. And then when it wasn't that, and it was something more, thoughtful and genuine and sincere, I, you know, kind of flipped for that, and I really liked that. So I wonder if it's like, oh, I like this movie because it's not what I expected, and now I can see it knowing what to expect, and I still really like it a lot, but I won't say there are problems.
Well, there are problems.
There are, I mean, well, of course there are problems, yeah. chief among them, honestly, and again, you brought this up with Celeste and Jesse Forever, you know, endings are the hardest thing to do in a movie, and if you can stick an ending to a movie that's not that great, people will like it better, you know, because that's what you walk out of the theater with, that memory. And I think Adventureland messes up its ending a little bit. I think, like you said with Celeste and Jesse, I think there's sort of an obvious ending, and then someone said, we need to fix that, and they went back and reshot this other thing. And again, we'll get more specific about that later on. I want to give people a chance to listen a little bit. The movie is very episodic, and I think that's by design, because, like I said, it's based on Greg Mottola's own experiences working at this theme park. And the thing that I like best about the movie is how much it feels like the memories of a guy who lived through this.
Yes.
There are so many movies that take place in the past that just put some songs on the soundtrack and dress people up in the most obvious of clothes from the era. And that's how they recreated the 80s or the 70s or the 50s. And I'm a big Stand By Me fan, but I mean, Stand By Me is like, let's have the kids talk about Mighty Mouse and Superman, and let's play Lollipop on the soundtrack. And the whole thing is just drenched in this sort of manufactured nostalgia. And I really like Stand By Me, so I'm not knocking that movie. But I mean, maybe like The Wedding Singer is a better thing to point to, is like, I call bullshit. I won't say that Adventureland is as good as something like Dazed and Confused. Because Dazed and Confused is a masterpiece, and Adventureland isn't. But I do think they have some things in common in terms of where they come from within the writer-director. Dazed and Confused feels very much like the memories of a guy who was there, who lived through this, who remembers the songs that were playing, and they weren't just the hits that come, you know, in the Time Life packages. And who remembers the clothes that everyone was wearing and the way that people kind of talked. And Adventureland, I think, the way that Dazed and Confused does for the 70s, Adventureland, I think, does a lot of that for 87.
I made a little talking point memo here for myself. You hit on a lot of the points right there in your opening spiel, so I'll kind of dance and figure out exactly what I'm going to say. I agree with a lot of what you have to say, and like the first thing that struck me about the movie, and again, I hadn't seen it I've actually seen, I was explaining this to you before, you can cut this out if you want, I've actually seen it twice, because like I said, we rescheduled this podcast a couple of times, and I saw it like 3 weeks ago when we were originally supposed to do this, and I wanted to see it again. So I have seen it twice. And both times, even though I saw them, you know, very close together, both times the thing that strikes me is the thing you were just talking about, and it's a very sort of filmmaking 101 type of thing, but it's the atmosphere. There's just, and it's so hard to sort of pin down exactly how you achieve that, but, Greg Mottola does a great job. Like, I mean, you feel like you're with, it has that certain, like, not only, it's not just about a time and a place, it's about, like, you know, where you are in your life, and, like, a certain amount of decisions lie ahead of you, and you have a certain amount of life experience behind you, but uncertainty resides somewhere in the middle, and, you know, I'm just bumbling and stuttering here because like it's just, and that's a testament to like how, cause like you can't, like I can't even make a lucid point about like how, but it's just so fucking good at placing you in that time. And not only in, like I said, not only in that time, but in that emotional place with these people. There's just like, it's so honest about the characters. One of my favorite things, like I noticed this both times I saw it in the first like three scenes of Jesse Eisenberg's character, James, looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
He uses the phrase per se, like three different times in a row, always when he's looking for a job. Mm-hmm. This has nothing to do with like the movie taking place in 1987, mind you.
Right.
This is all just about having a respect and like a knowledge for the characters that you're creating. He uses the phrase per se. Like he says, like, I've never driven a cement truck per se, or I've never worked in a restaurant per se. And then he goes to Adventureland. I said, I've never done this per se. Like, and that just sort of like gets at his like sort of over intellectual, you know, stammering, you
right,
know,
right.
Whatever. And just from there, I'm just totally sold. Like, I just want to go on this trip with these people, and that's like half the battle when you're making a movie. But I mean, it's so many people screw that up, and he does not.
And that's the kind of movie that it is too. Is that it's about introducing a group of people and then just spending a summer.
Yes.
Hanging out with them.
Yep.
I mean, the big sort of narrative thrust of the movie is sort of the relationship between Jesse Eisenberg and M, played by Kristen Stewart. That's really what's at stake. Otherwise, it's just sort of this hangout movie, the goings-on at this amusement park. I should say that the movie basically is Jesse Eisenberg plays a guy who just graduated from college, is planning on going to graduate school. His parents fall on hard financial times and aren't able to pay for grad school, and so he has to get a summer job and finds, you know, with his background and stuff, he's not necessarily qualified to do a lot, and he ends up working at this theme park where he makes friends and meets a girl and falls in love, and it was the summer that changed our lives forever.
Yes.
And it does have that feeling of, like you said, this sort of transitional period being stuck between these two places, which is, like, this part of your life is over,
mm-hmm.
and now, you know, when you're in school all these years, everything can be sort of characterized by years. I finished this year. I have this many to go. And then all of a sudden when you graduate college, it's like, okay, now the next thing is the rest of my life. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There is no next step. It's like, okay, now it's scary and vast. And the movie doesn't necessarily get swallowed up in a lot of that because it really just wants to sort of focus on this summer and this group of people.
What I'm saying. Like, yeah, it makes you think about those things, but not in a way that gets like really sort of grandiose
and
existential in a way that like you mentioned Dazed and Confused. This movie obviously owes a debt to that movie, the work that movie does. The other movie that I thought about a lot was Noah Baumbach's Kicking and Screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie, that's a movie I like. And that's, you know, highly respected by a lot of people for good reason. But that movie always leaves me whenever I watch it. I'm always left with a really like whiny vibe. It's hard to shake.
Because in that movie, every character is Jesse Eisenberg.
Well, right. Yeah. And I mean, and that's a fine movie. That's a better movie than Adventureland, I would even say. But like, but I mean, the, I'm saying that the goals are different, and right. that like I don't get that feeling when I watch this movie, because it's sort of there's enough like interesting stuff going on.
Well, I think there's not to get too deep into Kicking and Screaming, especially if people haven't seen it. But part of the problem with Kicking and Screaming is that it is sort of just this movie about this mid-90s post-collegiate ennui, where it's just like, oh, what do I do? And at least Adventureland gives Jesse Eisenberg a goal, even if that is to go out with Kristen Stewart. Like,
yeah.
Because Kicking and Screaming is just like, I don't even know. And do I want to go back to my girlfriend? I don't know what to do, you know? And so it's just this weird hopelessness. And at least Adventureland feels more like it has a momentum to it.
A lot of hemming and hawing, yeah.
Yeah. I was very pleasantly surprised, I will say, that, again, maybe based on the marketing or going into the movie, based on what I had seen from Jesse Eisenberg prior to Adventureland, and keep in mind this came out in 2009, pre-Zombieland, pre-Social Network, From Rome with Love.
But 30 seconds or less?
30 minutes or less.
30 minutes or less.
Yeah. But post-Cursed, which is the werewolf movie that Jesse Eisenberg is in, that's one of the worst movies ever made. I really went in expecting him to just be not just the intellectual, but like a geek, like a stammering nerd who can't talk to girls. And you know what I mean? It's that character that you just, unfortunately, sort of the Michael Cera character, the character that Michael Cera tends to play in a lot of stuff. And I don't subscribe to the belief that Jesse Eisenberg and Michael Cera are interchangeable. I don't believe it at all. No. I don't subscribe to that at all, actually.
I don't think that, no.
But I did sort of expect that kind of a character, and he's not. And I like the fact that he has a confidence to him. He's able to talk to girls. In fact, he's pretty good at it. He's not just this sort of stock character from every, you know, teen movie ever made.
Teen sex comedy, specifically.
Right. And one of the things that I think has to come up when you talk about Adventureland in every conversation, and this I think is the movie that people point to, is Kristen Stewart. You know, she started out sort of on an interesting path, and she was in Panic Room, and she was in Zathura, and she was in Into the Wild. And she had sort of an interesting resume, and then Twilight comes along and changes everyone's perception of her, not just because of her, I'll say, bad performance in that movie. But, you know, life began to imitate art, and so she couldn't be seen out in public, and she was seen out in public all the time without seeming just tortured by it, and she's biting her lip.
Biting her lower
she's
lip.
Got her hands in her hair, and every it's hard to get words out because, people are watching, and celebrity's terrible. And she really became kind of insufferable, and her performances in those Twilight movies are bad, and so I think people really wrote her off.
Yeah.
And then you see her in Adventureland, and she's not doing anything really all that different in Adventureland, and she still has a lot of her bad habits, but you realize, like, oh no, she can be very good, and I would argue, in some instances, she's so good that people, it's that same thing with Seth Rogen, where it's like, she's so good at doing this one specific thing that people just assume there's no performance there. She's just being herself.
Yeah.
But that's not the case.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't like hang out with her, but I think
I do. Well, I used to. Now I'm team Rob.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole PR fallout you gotta deal with.
Yeah.
I'm with you on a lot of that. I am not what you would call a Kristen Stewart fan. Yeah. I don't know many who are, but I'm also not one of these like aggressive hater types. Just because I don't get that, and I've never seen a Twilight movie. I never really thought about her enough to form any sort of opinion.
Yeah.
But I will say that like her sort. This is what you were saying. Like whether or not she's like being her, you know, only acting as herself or not. I mean, I guess I don't really know, but the point that I'm going to make is that even if she's doing the same things, like you said, with the way that this story is told, her sort of weird, aloof, you know, distance, you know, the sort of distant, like, you know, just kind of I'm over it girl attitude really kind of works here.
Yeah.
Because she's supposed to be, like, really kind of jaded and complex and, you know, just sort of, like, darkly mysterious for this one guy.
Yeah.
That's the weird thing is that she only, like, she exists, like, she is a character, but, like, we really only care about her in terms of what she means to Jesse Eisenberg's character.
Sure.
I don't know, like, I guess I never really thought of it that way before when you're introducing, like, female halves of love interests.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, she really kind of only exists, like, she exists, well, I mean, I guess that's not true because she does have, like, a lot of the scenes where it's not just her and Jesse Eisenberg. But, like, that's how we're sort of introduced to her, and I feel like that's how we perceive her going forward.
Well, the ways in which you describe her as sort of being aloof and darkly mysterious, I mean, that's all true of the way that the Jesse Eisenberg character sort of mythologizes her or romanticizes her in her eyes. And, you know, she's something different really to everyone else who works at the park. They all have these different impressions of her, which I like.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the movie necessarily romanticizes her in the way that Jesse Eisenberg does. I don't think the movie sets her up as this dark and mysterious puzzle that has to be solved, nor does it go to the trouble of getting, you know, maybe 2/3 of the way through the movie and then point by point explaining, well, this happened to me when I was a kid and this is why I act this way. She's a character who does have an internal life. There are things in her past that are hinted at. There are things at home that are hinted at, but not hammered on.
Yeah.
And she's a character who makes some bad choices and who makes mistakes, and the movie is sort of willing to own those things and not again romanticize them as, well, this is why she does it, or to just immediately write them off and say it's okay because you're the Kristen Stewart character. You know, life is rarely as easy as it is in a movie, and so it's nice to every once in a while see a movie that's willing to sort of acknowledge a lot of the emotional gray area in which we engage when we're in a relationship.
Yeah, or, you know, trying to get into a relationship.
Absolutely, yeah.
But she's good. I'm still not, like, but I mean, I think I'm still hesitant to give her a lot of credit. I think it's a really good part for her in a really well-written movie. And I'm not really sure that I would say that, like, I wouldn't point to this and say, see, like how you said, I don't know if I would necessarily say, like, see what she can do. Like, I think it's a very fact-specific set of circumstances.
Sure.
I don't know.
But sure.
I mean, that's all, not that we're here to, like, issue referendums on Kristen Stewart's career, but that's, I don't know. Like, I mean, I think she's good in this movie because it's, like, a really good part for what she does, but I
agree with a lot of what you're saying, actually, but I do think that that's the only instance in which the name of the movie Adventureland is really brought up anymore. Is like when a critic is talking about, like, anybody who thinks Kristen Stewart is a terrible actress on the basis of X movie that I'm currently reviewing, look no further than Adventureland to see that she can act. And maybe you're right. Maybe it is just,
I mean, yeah, she can and she does here, but I wouldn't, but again, I mean, I don't know. I think it's pretty hacky to write something like that, but I wouldn't say, like, oh, look, she can do it. I'm like, yeah, she can do it when it's a very specific, you know, whatever. I'm right. I'm going around in circles here repeating myself.
Yeah.
But I want to talk for a second, about our guy, Ryan Reynolds.
Yes. He's our guy. Okay. I have no idea that he was,
well,
we owned him.
You know,
he's
I don't know. Ours. He's not a horse. He's Mr. Blake Lively, if you follow the tabloids.
But I heard about that.
Blake Lively has saddled that horse. But,
good job.
Good for them. anyway, for a long time, particularly in college, in 2005, I think that's when that movie came out. Is that when Waiting came out?
Oh, gosh. Sure.
I think Waiting came out in 2005.
Okay.
And I saw I saw Waiting. And I really liked it. But that's a movie that when I look back on it, like, I know it's an imperfect movie, but a lot of it really still makes me laugh, and I'll probably always think of it fondly. But I remember having discussions with my friends, I had a close group of friends who like all like got way into that movie, and we used to like watch it and quote it. It was like our, you know, just hang with me here.
This is a fascinating glimpse into 2005 you.
Just hang with me for a sec. The point I'm making is that we would always then try it from that movie going forward. We would always try, and this is post Van Wilder, and like, but we would try and say like, we just like went head over heels for Ryan Reynolds. We thought that guy was just the tits. We thought he was, you know, hilarious and sort of interesting, and like, it's like, why isn't this guy a legit movie star? What yeah. can, and then he went on, like, post Waiting is when he really started to do the crank out like shit and shit and shit. And but I still didn't think it was his fault. This is the reverse Kristen Stewart thing. I just thought he kept choosing bad projects. And so the question was always sort of hanging over me, like, what do we do? What does Hollywood do with Ryan Reynolds?
Yeah.
I'm not saying and again, I somehow missed Adventureland. Remember, I just saw it recently for the purpose of the podcast. So like, I didn't see it chronologically. He went on to, you know, make many more mistakes post Adventureland, obviously. Green Lantern Chief among them. But I'm not saying that Adventureland is the answer to the question, what do we do with Ryan Reynolds? But it is an answer. I think he's really good. I think it's an interesting mix of like, mm-hmm. he's funny enough without telling jokes. They play on the fact that he's a very handsome guy instead of like making him a goof,
right.
getting away from that. Like,
right.
he is sort of a, you know, the wise loner who doles out, you know, very sort of esoteric pieces of advice to people who need them. But he himself is also like kind of a pathetic weirdo, like loser guy.
Which only slowly kind of comes into focus.
Yeah. And well, exactly. And he goes like, he is very aware of like trying to like build up like this own facade of like the way people perceive him. And it's not really clear. Like we don't know how these people all met each other.
Right.
We are just sort of new into the world, as is Jesse Eisenberg. So we don't know, like, but I almost get the feeling like people like may have like thought he was so cool, and he kind of let them keep thinking that.
Yeah.
That's sort of the impression that I get. I'm getting more into the movie and getting away from Ryan Reynolds' performance, though. Like I just think he's really good, and I think this is an interesting role in his very interesting and mostly bad resume.
I agree with you, although I think our positions can be flipped in terms of Kristen Stewart and Ryan Reynolds, because I do think he's good, but more than him, I think it's an interesting character, and one that we don't always see in a movie, because lots of movies have presented us with the cool guy who is exposed as a fraud.
Yeah.
But that's not exactly what this movie
is doing.
And one of the things I like about the movie is that it doesn't present us with villains. I mean, he does some things in the movie that aren't cool. And he acts in a way that, you know, isn't always perhaps upstanding. But the movie doesn't necessarily judge him, and the movie acknowledges that his life is a certain way, sort of for a reason, without excusing his behaviors. And it doesn't present him as just a villain. You know, there are some small, like the guys who chase Jesse Eisenberg through the park, like those guys are just a-holes. Even Lisa P, who is sort of the pretty popular girl that everyone at the theme park wants to sleep with, eventually goes out on a date with Jesse Eisenberg, and you just, you know, she's sort of vapid or whatever, and it's like, okay, here's where the movie just presents her as this shell of a human being who's horrible. But I don't think even the movie presents her as completely one-dimensional or evil. I mean, Jesse Eisenberg tells her something that he shouldn't tell her because he's upset or because he wants acceptance or approval, or he wants to have gossip, something to tell Lisa P. And then he says, you know, but you can't tell anyone.
Yeah.
And then she does. And of course that's wrong. But I think the movie also acknowledges that, like, what's the story? Like, you knew I was a scorpion. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yes.
You knew she was going to do that when you told her. I mean, you had to. So back to Ryan Reynolds. I think it's an interesting, I think it's a really interesting character that he plays. I do think he's good, and I think it I think it plays with his celebrity in an interesting way. And Ryan Reynolds is a frustrating guy because he makes a ton of bad movies. And in almost every case, people come away from it saying, like, he's not the problem. Like, he's yeah. good in this thing that's bad.
You're and talking why, to the president of that.
And why can't right he be in a thing that's good? And he's made a couple movies that I really like. I don't know if you've ever seen The Nines.
I have seen The Nines. The Nines is great.
That movie's amazing, and he's great in that. I feel like if Adventureland came out now, or maybe even a year or two from now, it would be the kind of movie, especially because when it did come out, he hadn't had quite so many high-profile bombs. He hadn't made Green Lantern yet. He hadn't made The Change-Up. You know, he's had some movies that really tanked, and a lot of people are basically pointing to him and saying, he's not a movie star. We keep saying he's one, but he can't open a movie. I think if Adventureland came out, you know, this year, next year, it would be the kind of movie that people point to. The way they pointed to, do you remember when Hollywoodland came out?
I remember that Hollywoodland came out.
It was about, you know, the George Reeves suicide / murder, and Ben Affleck was in it, and he played George Reeves, and it was sort of this smaller character part in this sort of pseudo-indie movie, and everyone looked at that and said, hey, that's what Ben Affleck should be doing. Maybe he's this character actor, you know.
Yeah.
This is an interesting change of pace for him. He's gotten away from just handsome leading man, and he's doing something, a supporting role in the movie that maybe doesn't work but is interesting or whatever. And I think if Adventureland came out next year, that's exactly what people would be saying. Hey, look, Ryan Reynolds is doing this supporting role in this smaller, interesting movie, and maybe he deserves a second look. Maybe he's not just the guy who was in Green Lantern, which sucked.
Which is kind of what happened to me, having seen this movie after the fact. I'm not a dummy. Like, I know it came out 3 years ago. But, like, I mean, seeing how it's all gone and then seeing this, I sort of did have the reaction that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I know where it fits, you know, chronologically. But I don't know, maybe, you know, a bout of hindsight has walked over me. And I don't know if that means that people are right, that he can't, like, lead a movie or something. I mean, I don't know. And I don't like to... I've changed a lot since 2005. I'm wiser. I don't pray to the altar of waiting and Ryan Reynolds as much anymore.
I love, too, that you make this delineation that, like, after waiting, he made a bunch of shit. Like, man, you know, most people would consider waiting a part of that shit.
Oh, no. See, I defend that movie vigorously, and that is a subject for another show.
But it's interesting when he does do these sort of smaller parts. The other one that I'm thinking of, I mean, he got a lot of good attention for Adventureland.
Yeah.
And the other one is Smoke and Aces, which is a movie that not a lot of people liked. I actually do, but a lot of people pointed out, like, hey, that Ryan Reynolds, he's actually good in this. And I think at that time it was more of a change of pace for him. He wasn't Ryan Reynolds' action star yet.
Yeah.
This was pre-X-Men Origins Wolverine, pre-Green Lantern, pre-Safe House.
Was it pre-Blade Trinity, or is that about? Is that around the same time?
I forgot about Blade Trinity. I don't know.
Well, that's okay, because the most memorable thing about Ryan Reynolds and Blade Trinity is that he has that tattoo on his pubes. I mean,
I was going to say his name tag, which said, "Hello, my name is Fuck You," which was, I think, the only thing that I liked about Blade Trinity.
Oh, okay. I really like the part with the pubes tattoo. that's what I liked. Anyway.
The rest of the cast in the movie is good, obviously, as well.
You
have Martin Starr playing, you know, the Martin Starr part. But he gets the great scene where, and again, that's another good Kristen Stewart moment where she kind of sticks up for him. And she doesn't quite say the things that you want her to say, but you appreciate that she's sort of protective of this character.
Yeah.
And you have the Matt Bush character, and I don't remember his name in the movie, but he's just the guy that keeps punching Jesse Eisenberg.
His name is Frigo.
Frigo, there
a hilarious name. Like, you know, a movie that tries to give a guy a funny name and kind of knocks it out of the park when that's so hard to do. Yeah,
but
his name is Frigo.
His part in the movie, again, to me, speaks to this idea. I mean, that's not the kind of part you write. Like, you put that guy in the movie because you knew that guy, and he used to do that stuff. And he was the worst, but, like, you were friends with him because he was the only guy you knew. Like, so you were sort of forced to be friends with Frigo, even though you hated being around him. And so that's just another one of those things that I think the movie really gets right. And it, you know, that's what's good about the movie is that I think it gets to some – I won't say universal, but for lack of a better word, some universal truths without necessarily, while still being very specific. It's very specific to this place, to this time, to these people, and yet there's something that I think, you know, we can all relate to. And I think most movies do one or the other. They get real specific, and it's like, I can identify with that, and nobody else can. Or when they want to be relatable, they have to go just so broad because they're so worried that maybe, you know, someone might not be on board. And I think Adventureland does a nice job of doing both.
Yeah. First of all, before we get too far away from Frigo, because we're almost at the end of the free of what I feel is the Frigo part of this show, they could have done, like, I mean, that kid is so funny. Like, they could have done that nut punching gag like 24 more times. I probably still would have laughed. And I don't, like, I mean, that is like the broadest of broad comedy moments in the whole movie, really.
Yeah.
But they still work somehow, even though they appear to be totally incongruous, which totally flies in the face of what I was saying at the beginning about Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. But God damn, I mean, that Michael Bush just makes it all work. Is that his name? Matt Bush, sorry.
But again, you know, you can't necessarily compare that to the Bill Hader Kristen Wiig stuff because it does.
It feels more personal.
It feels organic to the story that's being told, whereas Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig, again, maybe those characters in the movie, because Greg Mottola had a boss like that with a weird wife who might have been a slow adult. I don't know. But, like, they feel more like a studio note.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about the music and about the songs that they chose. I want to talk about that too, because that really stuck out to me. Because to quote Barry from High Fidelity, the soundtrack kicks fucking ass this movie.
Yeah.
You alluded to the fact that they don't choose, like I think you said, the Time Life Classics catalog of songs,
right?
But they do sort of juxtapose a lot of really popular pop songs,
yes,
like Wang Chung and Crowded House, and like White Snake pops up, and like those guys in the bar singing Hot Blooded, with like these like obviously like really dense and like cool Lou Reed Velvet Underground songs, and it almost speaks to like the sort of world that they're living in. Like, you know, they, like, you know, they, like, they're working at this sort of very, like, friendly place, but they sort of lead these really dark and mysterious lives. But it doesn't feel so heavy-handed. Like, when you hear the music, it kind of just, like, the music just kind of flows in and out. I don't like that in the movie they point out the fact that they're playing Rock Me Amadeus too much.
Yeah.
I want that joke to kind of play on its own. I don't like that they point out, like, why is the song always play? Because it's hilarious every time that song starts.
Right, right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I like you said, that it suggests these different worlds that the characters are living in, that certain characters are top 40 characters, and then you have the Martin Starr, Jesse Eisenberg characters who are listening to their placements in The Cure, and 87 just itself being this weird melting pot of, you have sort of these underground or new wave bands that were just sort of coming up, and then you have the top 40 stuff, and you have the appearance of like the hair metal starting to come in, and then it's all these things kind of happening at once, and that it's all being played at this amusement park. And again, it speaks to, I don't mean to keep beating on this drum, but it feels like the memories of a specific guy. It doesn't feel like a guy who's trying to remember 1987 for everyone else. Like, this is what it might have been like if you were there, because that's The Wedding Singer or whatever. I mean, The Wedding Singer plays it all for laughs, so.
Yeah.
The song choices that show up in Adventureland feel like it's because Greg Mottola remembered that Rock Me Amadeus played every day.
Yeah,
or, you know, he remembers the song that was on when he went on that ride when he was stoned, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember what the song is in that sequence, but...
Yeah. They do something really cool, and I picked it up only because I watched them in such close succession. It was kind of a... I don't think... And people don't normally do that with movies, but, like... they do something really interesting with Pale Blue Eyes, the Velvet Underground song. Mm-hmm. It plays the first time when they're... in the car, the first time that M and James go riding in the car together, and it's like, that's a great song, obviously, and it really fits, it's used in that scene perfectly. But it's not, they're not listening to the song. That's a song that's on the soundtrack. because then, like, they get out of the car and, like, it's still playing. It's not on the car radio.
Right.
I think the nerdy film school for that, what is that called? There's a name.
Diegetic sound.
It's
non-diegetic.
That is extra diegetic sound.
Right.
It's non-diegetic at that moment. And that's a great song. And, like, you don't really think of it. Like, oh, that's a song that's on the soundtrack to this movie that takes place in the 80s, whatever. But then, towards the end, when he's, like, drunk in the bar, he puts that song on the jukebox.
Right.
And it sort of exists within the world. It's just kind of like, I mean, that's like a really super obscure thing that people probably didn't even think about. But like, it's just like a little trick that's like, it just makes the whole thing feel a lot more organic. And like you're experiencing, like, the songs mean the same thing to the characters that they mean to you. It's not just a song that was chosen because it's cool.
Right.
It's a song that the character obviously has an affinity for.
Right.
But they show that to you after you already heard it. I thought that was just interesting. That's just a little, you know, film making nerd stuff. But like,
let's talk about the end, and then we'll wrap up. If you've listened this far, and you don't want to have the ending spoiled, go ahead and tune out. Chances are you haven't listened this far if you've not seen Adventureland. But we are going to talk about the end of the movie. So it's revealed that M has been sleeping with Ryan Reynolds the whole time.
Yeah.
And Jesse Eisenberg is obviously very hurt by this revelation. And I really think, and I won't say I've been in the exact situation, like back when I was in high school maybe, but I know I was in similar situations.
You're in, sure.
And I'm positive I've been probably each one of those people at one time or another. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure of it. And I really think the movie gets a lot of that right. The way that feels. There's this weird, and I can't explain it, but Jesse Eisenberg's reaction and Kristen Stewart's reaction both have this awful, sick to your stomach kind of hurt to them. One, because he feels betrayed. One, because she feels so terrible about betraying someone. I think they're both so good in those scenes. And that's always the scene that I think of when I think that Kristen Stewart actually is really good in this movie, is that she handles that moment.
I'll give you that. Yeah, she is really good
well.
In that scene. Yeah.
And in a way that, like, a girl her age would. She doesn't necessarily process it all super maturely. But nor should she, because she's, you know, 20 or 21 or whatever. So I think she gets it right. And I think the movie could kind of end there. I think Jesse Eisenberg has learned a lot about himself. I think even if he decides, okay, I'm going to just go to New York and get a job and not necessarily have this cushy life in grad school, but start my life, whatever that's going to be, on my own terms and fend for myself, I'm okay with all of that. But I feel like the happy ending of the two of them together in the apartment feels forced. And I say that as someone who loves a happy ending. I love when the couple makes it work and gets together and it ends with them happy, because that's just how I am. So on that level, the ending is satisfying to me, because I'm like, no, they belong together. And they both get to have sex now. And,
in New York.
Yeah, right. So that's fine. But so much of it feels like a reshoot to me from just the weird location. It feels different from the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And to me, it feels like, you know, the notes of a test audience saying, like, we want them to get together. And so they do. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I think I disagree with you, actually.
That's fine.
I don't... Oh, it's fine. I'm allowed. Yeah, no. Yes.
You'll never be on again, but it's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Well, then I'm really not going to hold back. I agree with you 100% about their performances and the way that they process those moments. That's all great, and they capture those emotions like exactly what you were talking about. Like, they sort of crystallize that in what are pretty short scenes, really.
Yeah.
So kudos to them. I think from a storytelling standpoint, I get really frustrated, not with the ending, because I'll get to my feelings about the happy ending in a second. I have a problem with all the stuff that leads up to that, because it's just not very interesting to watch from a sense of, like, it essentially amounts to people being told pieces of information by other people, like, over the span of, like, 5 minutes. And, like, you know, this isn't, like, an action movie. There's not going to be some climactic car chase. Like, like, this is a movie about people who hang out and, like, know each other's gossip. I understand. Like, I'm not an indie. I understand that. But I think it's a some really weird choices are made in terms of, first of all, they have the, you know, sort of slow parking lot attendant guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They have him be the one who breaks the news to Jesse Eisenberg about Ryan Reynolds and Kristen Stewart.
Yeah.
That's a weird choice.
Yeah.
And kind of took me out of it both times. And then he has that weird exchange with Lisa P when he's so offended that she, you know, spilled the beans about them being together, and then that, you know, sort of drove her away, and then he has guilt about that. It feels sort of manufactured to me. You alluded to that moment before as, like, a way that, like, it sort of shows how he is sort of contradictory of himself and sort of flawed. But to me, it just seemed really just kind of strange that he would think to approach her about that at that moment. After, like, I don't know why he would even care. That's after he finds out about Ryan Reynolds and Kristen Stewart, yes? I think it is.
Yeah, well, isn't the whole reason because he wants to tell Lisa P, basically? Like, he sort of wants to hurt Kristen Stewart, no? Maybe I could be remembering this wrong. It's been a few weeks since I saw it.
I don't think so. And, like, and my point is that this is all really muddled, and I don't really like the way it plays.
Now, I agree.
Now, to your point, they nail those moments when they finally have to confront each other. All that's fine.
Yeah.
But all that stuff that leads up to that kind of leaves me just kind of amiss. I'm kind of confused about certain people's motivations, and even if I could figure that out, I'm not 100% pleased with how it's handled from a storytelling standpoint.
I totally agree with you, and I agree that it's not very cinematic, and it gets very muddled. I think I'm willing to give it a little bit more of a pass, and again, this probably speaks more to, like, my own high school experience, but there was I could identify a little bit with this idea that so much of these, you have the bad thing that happens, and then the way that that's processed is just through weird second and third hand information rather than talking to a person, you know, face to face. Like, I think there's some truth to that, but I also agree with you that that might not be satisfying to see in a movie. Exactly.
Yeah. So in that instance, because I too am like you, where I'm a real sucker for, like, you know, guys just, like, getting their shit together and, like, taking a bold action. Because I was left so sort of nonplussed about all the stuff that happened before, I'm really, like, I was really lift, like, I'm really lifted when he, like, just, like, decides to, like, get himself together and go see her in New York. Mostly, like, not even because it's just about, like, he has to reunite with her, but it's mostly, like, to do with, like, the fact that he has been trying for the entire movie. Well, he hasn't been trying for the entire movie because he, like, when it's revealed about his, you know, his parents sort of not having any more money, he can't. But he just wants to extricate himself from this situation. And it feels like it's all kind of building to that anyway. And then I mean, they're playing that Great Replacement song, and, like, he's on a bus at night. They're showing New York City through the rainy bus windows. And I don't know. Like I said, I mean, it's very, you know, toothpaste commercially to me. But I really dig it. I'm a sucker for that stuff, and it worked on me in a way that it did not work on you.
I don't know. Again, I like it in principle. I like the idea that, you know, he can sort of grow up and look past some things that have happened because he cares about this person, and if he wants to be with her, then he needs to get over it, basically. I mean, not, which isn't to say that, like, she didn't do something wrong and hurt him, but he's able to sort of look at the bigger picture, which he isn't always able to do, you know, especially as the movie starts. So in theory, I like so much of it. There's just something to me that's frustrating about the way that it's executed. But we both like the movie. I don't mean to end on a note where it's just like, oh, the ending's not great. Because I'm okay with the ending. It's not, it's certainly not a deal breaker.
I think the ending to this podcast is kind of going off the rails.
Definitely.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, we're sort of, it really strikes me that you said you really like that kind of ending, and I do as well, but it's sort of, I think it's interesting in terms of like what we take away from the things that lead to that ending and why it works for one of us and not the other. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Thanks for listening, everybody. If you haven't seen Adventureland and you've listened all the way through, like I said, it's on Netflix Instant. You should see it. It's a small movie that is interesting and probably better than a lot of what you saw at the theater this summer.
Definitely.
That's probably a safe bet, right?
Yeah, safe bet.
Thank you, Alex.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me on again. We'll try and have it not be such a long gap next
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I believe the it's next all, time.
It's awful fun. Yeah.
The next time you're on, I'm pretty sure it's going to be Scary Movie Month.
Oh, boy. Your favorite time of the year.
We are just days away. Weeks, I should say. Weeks away. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Remember, email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, and we will see you next week.
Patrick, if we were not separated by the internet, I would punch you right in the nuts as a way to conclude the show. We'll be right back.